This program is sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.
This radio program is PG-13. Parents strongly caution some material may be inappropriate for children under the age of 13. Send me free. Of the chains holding me.
Is anybody out there hearing me? Set me free.
Jesus' mission was to comfort those who mourn, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, and open prison doors for those who are bound. For those who want more than status quo Christianity has to offer, Blazing Grace Radio begins now. And here is your host, Mike Janung.
Hey, Mike Janung here, and welcome back to Blazing Grace Radio. Thank you for joining us on this 70-degree day in Phoenix. And I love the Valley of the Sun, especially this time of the year. And last week, we had Jim Tilley on the show, and he shared his story. He is has a doctorate in clinical psychology, and he's also a former pastor. And his story included a father who had been involved with sexual sin and sexual addiction and who ended up at one point in prison for it, and the profound impact that had on Jim's life. And at one point, Jim watching his dad videotape or film young girls at a swimming pool right in front of Jim and his mother, and then his path and struggles with sexual sin on his own side and pornography and masturbation, and then as a counselor doing inappropriate things with some of the women he worked with, and his journey through healing. And so today we're going to continue that conversation with Jim. So Jim, welcome back to the program.
It's a privilege to be here, Mike. Thank you.
So I'll begin by asking you, at what age did you have your first exposure to pornography?
Yeah, good question. It was probably around 13. I had an older brother that I think had an issue, or we just actually took turns going to the local drugstore to get the month's Playboy. Or two. So I was about 13. Mm.
And then where along the line did you discover masturbation?
You know, it was actually before that. When I was probably about 12, we lived in a different place, and I was probably too scared or ignorant or both probably to go find some actual pornography. I didn't really know much about that yet. But I would have mental fantasies about women started, and I would masturbate at night to those.
Mm. Last week, you shared the story of when your dad was filming girls at the swimming pool, and you said that you were around the age of 13. And
yes.
Now I'm putting that piece together. That's around the time you also discovered pornography. But I'm wondering, how did it affect you, a 13-year-old? That's a very tender age. How did it affect you seeing your dad do that, especially right in front of your mother?
Yeah, key question. And I had different responses, Mike, and no real way to put them all together. But, part of me was sort of, elated, because I was in puberty. I could definitely see why there was excitement. But I was kind of like, my healthier parts were kind of like, Dad, holy mackerel, what are you doing? Making a film of them? Whoa. I was a little bit surprised and appalled, and definitely both reactions, appalled for my mom's sake, but sort of, I admired my dad. He's a World War II hero and all this stuff. I admired and loved my dad. I sort of laughed when he was laughing at my mom. I laughed sort of along with him. So, boy, you talk about mixed messages. It couldn't have been more mixed. Some apprehension and horror, but a lot of intrigue and arousal and then just do your own thing was stamped like a iron stamp onto the soft clay of me. Make up your own rules. you know, and that most, as I said, most definitely that played into later, you know, hey, you know, crossing a boundary, holding somebody who's sobbing. Well, okay. Gee, if I'm not sexually aroused, well, that must be okay. Well, I'm making up my own rules, which was terrible. Mm. But yeah, in a nutshell, that was a very forming event. If my dad can do this and he's my dad, he's my hero. Well, you know, hey, it must be okay.
Mm. And I'm kind of wondering, at some point, there's a lot of screaming going on at your mom's side, at your dad, or a lot of fights in your household? Or
yeah, there some, and I don't think it was specifically over porn. It was maybe other things. But I think after that 13-year-old time, yeah, you know, and she would just kind of be mad at him and raging and get a loud volume, and he would just kind of joke back at her or tease her, kind of like the thing about, you know, when he was teasing her that he's going to take my 15-year-old brother to the prostitution house to get him, you know, broken in, he that was one of his pathological traits. He could be a real mean tease, and you know, he would just sort of walk off and go whatever after a while. And you know, it really taught me to avoid the truth. My mom said after their marriage finally ended, you know, the epitaph to the marriage, she said, was he never said an honest word in his life. Mm. And unfortunately, he taught me to, you know, repackage the truth, not tell the truth, you know, and live that way rather than realizing what I had to realize. You know, the truth is my friend. So, but yeah, there was conflict between them and lots of brokenness there. And it was really sad. After their divorce, my mom remarried to a guy that didn't have those issues. And boy, they traveled constantly. They were really publicly affectionate. And I was like, wow, my parents never took trips on their own. They never really were cuddly in front of us in a nice way, you know? And so it was really, really sad, you know, very sad.
And, if I remember right, you said your dad was an elder at the church and your family was going to church?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mainstream Presbyterian. And, you know, yeah, very much so. And that was a church that it was literally get your card punched on Sunday morning. They didn't talk about Jesus very much. I accepted Christ at a Billy Graham rally when he said you can have a personal relationship with Jesus. I was in Sunday school every Sunday growing up, pretty high IQ, you know, kid. I had never heard that before. And so I'm not surprised, Mike, because that was an empty shell of a church. Nothing was really processed about the inner world or how you let the love and tenderness and grace and the holiness of God really transform you. So yeah, you go there to be seen and get your card punched because you're a good American citizen. Click, you know, we just won World War II. Thank God for that. And you know, you go on about your business doing your other things. So, you know, yeah, that's a huge issue. And I know we'll get to this, but I'll go ahead and preach to the choir here. You know, the church, even the evangelical one, has a version of that track. You know, to me, the core issue in the church now is we really don't have a clue, hardly. We have some clues. We mostly don't have a clue about how to deal with sexual addiction in particular, nor really with our inner world. But since we love our pride, we're going to pretend that, you know, this is all hot-wired, we got it all, we're like the emperor's new clothes. Oh, no, you know. And you've seen this, Mike, you know, churches that will turn down a Blazing Grace conference because we don't have that problem in the church. Well, they sure the heck do. And, you know, men don't want to deal with it in the church because most of them are acting out themselves. 80% of men in the evangelical church are doing this. And women don't want to do it. And I say this tenderly, with respect, but women don't want to deal with this. Because, and my heart breaks as I say this, I respect you women, I do, believe me. But the majority of you women in the church have had some kind of molestation experience, and a lot of women don't know really how to deal with that, so we're not going to deal with that at all. We want this just to all go away. And again, I don't shame the women or the men, I don't shame them for that, but we've got to change, and we can get into that in a minute. But basically, you know, I'm not one to point fingers. because you know that's kind of what I did. I'm holding these women, but I'm not sexually aroused. I really see them as daughters, but I'm making up my own stuff, and that is pride. That is the core Genesis 3 sin. I can make up my own reality, and it ended in disaster. So, anyway, that's my thought about church for the moment.
So it kind of sounds like your dad was kind of a, I'm going to use the word Jekyll and Hyde when it came to the Christian life.
Yes. 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 And could be a real nice guy. I mean, in many other ways, and very charming, you know, and certainly very warm with me. So, but yeah, church-wise, we were there every week. And, you know, he compartmentalized, much like I learned to do. I learned it from him, but it was my sin that I continued in that, though. But, yeah.
And over the years, I've heard plenty of other stories of men who got their first exposure of porn from dad. And and I want to bring this up because dad has a very profound influence on their sons and daughters. Our fathers are meant to be kind of like a God stand-in. Not God, but kind of like a God stand-in. And when you got a lot of mixed messages like, well, we're going to go to church on Sunday, but after that, anything goes.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And from your
and even when I became an evangelical believer in 1969 at age 13, you know, I compartmentalized too. And it wasn't until much later that I really began to deal with the lordship of Christ. You can't have compartments with him. I mean, we do, and he gives us grace, but he wants to own all those things joyfully for his holiness and goodness and love. So, compartmentalizing.
So you said you went through three major depressions, and depression is a huge issue today. What were those depressions about? Yeah. What was going on?
Yeah, good one. I think a huge fuel for that was codependency, people pleasing, and the perfectionism. I remember, and you know, and of course for pastors, you know, that's a hog in the waller for codependents and perfectionists, because you know, if you do well, you know, a lot of people think you are God's, you know, St. Paul 2.0, and you know, God did a lot of good things through me in ministry. And I remember a woman specifically saying to me once, that was the best sermon I ever heard. That was wonderful. And a voice goes off in my head, you have to be more wonderful next week. And so for me, Mike, I think depression was when those were burning out. You know, they were not working. And so, my soul was realizing, none of this stuff can really make me feel accepted just as I am, you know, and at a very deep level. I preached a lot on grace, but really flowing in deep healing grace was a long journey. And so, yeah, those are basically that was the driving force. And I loved Jesus, and I believed he loved me. But, you know, it's kind of back to the thing, lust was still an issue, and you know, kind of really feeling like unconsciously he doesn't really know about the depth of my lust because he can't handle it. You know, Jesus really can't handle that. So that's the answer. I mean, it was really that stuff, and I got depressed again this last season because I think I finally realized that many people that I hurt were just not willing to ever talk to me or reconcile or forgive, let alone reconcile. So I kind of felt a deeper sense of having to embrace the disaster. And I think my people pleasing and codependent parts and perfectionism was just completely flipping out because I have to have these people bless me, I thought, you know, and they're not gonna, you know. So I've gone through a depression. The third one was just now, basically, and it's getting some healing this past week. But
when you say major depression, what does that look like? You're just crashed for a couple weeks, a month, or
several months at a time. Usually, it looks like this last time I lost 25 pounds because my appetite went to heck. I could sleep. In fact, I was very sleepy a lot. I was sleeping maybe 12 hours a day. Feeling also anxiety goes with depression very, very strongly. It certainly did for me. And a very jittery sense of feeling like a can of soda that's set out in the hot sun and has been shaken a lot. It looks fine, but it feels like it's about to explode. And a lot of the time, Mike, I tell you, I just felt like at any moment, even sitting home alone, I was just going to explode with anxiety and fear and terror. Terror about what? Well, terror about toxic shame. I mean, maybe I really am the one person in the world that Jesus really can't handle. You know, and so waves of terror, waves of sadness, waves of some self-hatred. But, you know, God led me to just keep crying out to him. And, you know, he's really melting on through a lot of those defensive people-pleasing and perfectionism. But, yeah, it's just terrible. You know, I'm a real extrovert, as is probably obvious. But, boy, you know, even going to church was hard, being around people. I just wanted to be alone with my wife and cry and sob, and you know, it did a lot of that. And if you know anyone out there, man or woman, is just struggling with depression, please don't feel ashamed, because Charles Spurgeon, one of the greatest preachers in the 1800s, struggled massively with severe depression most of his life. There is help and healing, and there's nothing wrong with getting medication. I went on an antidepressant about a month ago. I've been on them before. There's no shame in getting the help you need. And depression does not mean you're an inferior Christian. People who love Jesus deeply and are faithful and, you know, didn't commit, you know, some sort of public sin like I did, you know, all kinds of people like that. Depression is incredibly common, but people just tend to hide it, you know, so you think you're all alone. I want to tell you passionately, you're not. It's a very common thing and nothing to be ashamed of. Get professional help. You deserve it.
And so have you been able to identify how much of this that you've gone through has to do with spiritual warfare and the enemy pouring lies into your mind about hopelessness and this other stuff?
Yeah, I think that's some of it. I look at spiritual warfare kind of this way. I think the evil one feeds on unrepentant sin, and I certainly repented of everything. He also feeds on wounds, you know, and I think when we're wounded and toxically shamed by parents or by really, really a close community, because really my old community, church and surrounding community, kind of became my replacement family. And the downside of that was, you know, they really did reject me and didn't want to give me grace. But yeah, I think the evil one feeds on wounds of shame, because basically, you know, what happened with my community is some of the healing I had from my parental wounds got substantial healing, and that sort of ripped off all the scabs. And again, I'm not blaming others, but, you know, it was my sin that got this ball rolling. But I think the evil one feeds on wounds and unrepentant sins and, yeah, tries to lie to you and say, indeed, you know, I think his core lie is you're all alone in this. Mm. If people know the real you, they won't like you. Well, you know, and there were some people that found out how needy I was and couldn't handle that. But there's a lot of people who know the real me, needy, broken, fragile, terrified, inner child just bouncing off the wall. And they do convey God's grace and love. Like you said, that was a very excellent comment, Mike. The Father is kind of a channel or a conduit for God's fatherly love. But yeah, the evil one will play off that and tell you, no, you're the only one. So that's why it's essential to get in a group, many, many groups if you can, and groups where you can be really transparent and authentic. Because that really dispels a lot of those lies. When someone else says, wow, I went through that similar thing, and they spill their guts and talk about how broken and shabby and horrible they feel inside, even though they look fine, then you realize, okay, you know, we all have this outer presentation world, but we all have an inner world. And for all of us, there's brokenness there, there's toxic shame, there's terrifying, nail-biting fears, and that is nothing to be ashamed of. Mm. So the devil's number one strategy, I think, disbelieve the written word of God is the hugest one, certainly. Disbelieve God, turn away from God is the biggest. But a second one is, turn away from people. Isolated Christian is a paralyzed Christian.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's huge.
So on that note, when I go and speak in churches, I'll sometimes ask the flock to raise their hand that they meet with another believer once a week, consistently, yeah, for the purpose of support, prayer, accountability, and usually only maybe 15% on average put their hands up, maybe 20%. I was in a church, yeah, in England last year and asked that question, and one hand went up. So why, Jim, since you are a pastor, why is there, why, what have we lost, and why have we lost, and why are so many believers isolated?
Yeah. Well, Mike, at the essence of it, I have to say bluntly, I think we've lost the real gospel, which is that Jesus is up to the job of handling everything, capital E, everything, everything inside of us. And that's the core issue. We don't feel like he is going to be able to love me, heal me, forgive me, save me, and then walk with me. Whereas, in fact, you know, if somebody's in the middle of masturbating, God is, Jesus is right there, and he's loving you just as much while you're masturbating as he did before and after. And he just wants to free you from that, because it's like drinking raw sewage. We have kids. Yeah, we don't want our kids drinking raw sewage. He loves you. So, you know, we really don't think, and the core issue is we project, you know, the wrong image onto Jesus. You know, we project some grace, but man, he's getting kind of fed up with you. And, you know, you're running out of time, and he's just going to roast you like a turkey. Well, I encourage people to get a book called Gentle and Lowly. Gentle and Lowly by a pastor named Dane Ortlund. Dane is a dog, big dog, Great Dane Ortlund. He has one of the best 200 pages of what is Jesus's heart. His heart runs to our brokenness, our deepest shame, our most icky sin. And then from there, we have to become a church that models that. And I think, Mike, the turning point has to be in seminary. Because in seminary, I think we're just really prepared. You know, they talk about you're still a sinner as a pastor, but they really don't equip you to deal with your own sin. The church and pastors both expect that when you become a pastor, you're beyond sin. You really are. So, you know, there's Philip Yancey, and everybody freaks out. Well, hello, you know, he still was a sinner. I'm not excusing what he did. I'm just saying our job number one is dealing and caring for sin. We are a hospital. We're a MASH unit, a mobile army hospital. We're a MASH unit for the problem of sin. So why do we go around pretending that it's a minor or rare issue? You know, I mean, if I went to my doctor and, you know, he diagnosed my cancer and I said, no, I don't want surgery. That's too extreme. You know, he'd freak out. He goes, Jim, that's what I'm here for, is to heal you. And, you know, it's going to be a culture change. I think we have to have people speaking in churches and realize that a lot of people are going to keep blowing us off. But I think we got to snowball this thing. And when people post about Philip Yancey, we have to say, look, Philip Yancey is from the same cloth as every darn one of us. And the sooner we create a culture that says we're not going to be surprised by sin, but we're going to go after it in great love, and we're going to have an open fellowship where, you know, you talk about it. I remember that movie about the Jesus Revolution that came out, and I was involved in the Jesus Revolution in the 60s and 70s. In Southern California, you know, they're sharing prayer requests, and the drummer in the band says, yeah, hey, pray for me. I got to go to court next week for my drug hearing because I'm still using and sometimes I fall down. Why can't the church be a place that does that?
Jim, I agree. You know? And we got 1 minute left. One last question. How did this affect your wife?
How did this affect my wife? She was very devastated, very much so. But, you know, the main way I've had to deal with that, here's my 30 seconds, is her recovery takes a lot longer than mine. And guys, if that's what you're dealing with, remember, her recovery is going to take a lot longer. But if you humble yourself before her and pray for her and honor her feelings and honor her pace, That will help her more than anything you can imagine. My wife is doing well now, but by the grace of God, and so are we. So transformation and healing of marriage and wives is very possible, but you have to seek it and be humble.
All right. Thank you, my friends, and thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Mike.
We'll see you next time.
Do you want to be free?
Blazing Grace is a nonprofit international ministry for the sexually broken and the spouse. Please visit us at blazinggrace.org for information on Mike Janung's books, groups, counseling, or to have Mike speak at your organization. You can email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call our office in Chandler, Arizona at 719-888-5144. Again, visit us at blazinggrace.org. Email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call the office at 719-888-5144.
This program was sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.